This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Human behavior, of course, very complex. Why people do things can stem from their upbringing, peers, financial status, the list goes on and on. But sometimes the things that influence your behavior might not be visible. My next guest examines the invisible things that guide human behavior. Lulu Miller is co-host of the NPR podcast Invisibilia. The show is now in its second season. Lulu speaks tomorrow afternoon at CAM Raleigh. It's part of the Hopscotch Design Festival. Welcome to the program, Lulu. Good to have you here.
It's so nice to be here.
Tell us what sparked your interest in what got Invisibilia going. I know you have an interest in human behavior. Tell us about the genesis of this.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I've always, for a long time, been a little bit drawn to stories about why things fall apart. So whether that's a relationship breakup or a personal failure, these are the stories as a listener I kind of always lean into. And I love to see, just as a human in the world, how people pull themselves back up. I find that very useful, personally, for all the failures I encounter. And so I've just always been drawn to those stories. I don't know why, I just am. A few years ago, 2013, I met the incredible reporter Elise Spiegel. She helped start This American Life, and then for about a decade was doing mental health reporting for NPR. And we met at a radio conference and started talking about ideas and stories. And she had this story she really wanted to do about what you think about your thoughts can have profound influences for your behavior. Now, that may sound really abstract. What she meant was she had heard this story of a man who was plagued by incredibly violent thoughts. So everywhere he looked, he'd picture horrific things like pushing someone into a river, stabbing them, really, really horrible. And the thoughts were only getting worse. And he wondered, well, oh my gosh, if these thoughts are in my head, does that mean I want to do them? And he was to the point where he was ready to commit himself to a mental hospital. And he finally came across this therapist who said, you know what? Thoughts, they don't necessarily mean anything. You don't have to worry so much. And actually, what I think you have is a form of OCD where you can't stop thinking about violent things. And what I want to do to show you that you're not going to do anything is have you hold a knife to my throat for 10 minutes and show you you're not going to do anything. And so this man, you know, this therapist, he came to that diagnosis with that man after a few sessions, but he really helped this guy see that, wow, his thoughts don't necessarily mean anything. And what Elise pitched to me was doing a whole big episode about how the psychotherapeutic community is undergoing this massive revolution from sort of the place of Freud, where every thought meant something and the goal of therapy is to unpack it and decide what it means, to this huge shift that's going on where more and more therapists are sort of believing, you know what, the way to wellness is to show you that you don't need to take a thought so seriously. And the way to relief is to saying thoughts might mean nothing. And so we got together, did that story, you know, held butcher knives to therapists' throats and interviewed, you know, like a kind of mix of emotion and theory and history. And that was our first episode. And sort of she brought the very, the human behavior framing and looking at systems and how beliefs are constructed culturally. And then I just brought the, boy, I like to see how people get through hard situations. And that's sort of how the show came to be.
And it's a fascinating trajectory that you've had since then. Take us back a little bit, even before Invisibilia and your collaboration with Elise Spiegel, to talk about what you were listening to. Because I know you had a job where you listened to a lot of radio and you became enthralled with Radiolab. Maybe you can take us back to those kind of deep meditations you were having earlier on.
Yes. Well, that was the, I kid you not, best informed year of my life. I was working in a wood shop for a furniture designer as his assistant. I'd done a lot of sculpture, studio art in college, and it was my first job out of college in New York. And, you know, found it on Craigslist, had minimal skills, but he just needed someone quick. And so that was my job for the first year. And we had the radio, we had public radio on all day, every day, 8 hours a day. And I was absorbing information. I just noticed I was absorbing information so much better than I do, you know, when I read it or from the TV, that for me, radio was just the sweet spot. And And it was like such a delightful job because you just get the range of the show. So you get the culture talk show and the politics and the city affairs. And then Terry Gross comes on. Anyway, so that was this sort of year of falling in love with radio. I really didn't know how much I loved it until then. And on the weekends, I would hear shows like This American Life or Radiolab, which are extremely narrative and basically like little movies for the ear. And I found myself laughing and crying and just having these huge emotional responses. And I just thought, I want to do that. I have no skills or qualifications, but I want to do it. And Radiolab was being produced in New York. And there was something about the proximity of just, this is down the street. And so I basically, you know, I listened to the first episode. The first episode I heard was on emergence. And the question of that is, they tell this story of fireflies that blink as one. And they say, you know, well, how do they do that? There's no leader. There's just order emerging out of the masses. And I was just so taken in by the question and by the sound design. And then I sort of binge listened to five more episodes that night and basically wrote them a love letter and just said, I have no skills, but I will do anything. You don't need me, but sometimes you know, anyway. And then I volunteered for them one day a week for about a year. And then finally, you know, when they got money to hire somebody, they sort of hired me over people with talent because I knew how to do the really boring things like upload audio to the FTP, you know.
Yeah.
I could. And then once I was in and they were paying me, they're like, oh, so let's teach this girl how to tell some stories. So I really feel so lucky. I kind of fell in love with radio just before the podcasting explosion hit and it became cool. So I was still there when there weren't as many people in love with it. And
How did that experience, because you talked about these being little movies for the ear, and I think that you're onto something there. The images that audio triggers are so much more powerful than what's on the screen because they are in your head. They're in your head and they're yours. So they were instigated by something from the outside, but ultimately they're coming from, you know, the phone calls coming from inside the house, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did Radiolab then inspire the construction of Invisibilia, or did it?
Yeah, well, actually, I think it really did because so Elise came out of This American Life and I came out of Radiolab. And one way to talk about the differences of that show, of those shows, is This American Life is sort of more scripted in between cuts of tape when they tell a story. And Radiolab is sort of conversation based. They'll often use a very loose conversation as the narration, they'll kind of cut it down. Anyway, and so Elise, when we would just battle it out at the beginning, I'd say, no, before you sit down and think about how to write this story, we've collected all the tape. Before you sit down and write, just talk to me with no plan. Just let's like record what we call a brain dump where you just take 2 hours and we're authentically talking. And she's like, no, what? That's a waste of time. I gotta make
it. It's a reporter's nightmare, Lou. So
right. But, and so we would, you know, I think we the thing about conflict is, I think with creative teams, it can feel really bad. It can feel really frustrating. But then often that is the spark, like that, exactly that difference in what's hard in those battles make a new sound. And so I think she pulled me over into like really playing with writing, and I pulled her a little into, you know, like, let's just let go of the script. And I think we kind of evolved, not necessarily a new sound for radio, but for both of us, we sort of changed each other. And so there was that was, I think, the biggest place was just the influence of the conversational style of Radiolab coming into Invisibilia a little bit.
That's very cool. Well, let's give us an example. Maybe we can talk about the episode called How to Become Batman. We have a clip, but maybe you can set it up for us and tell us about that episode.
Yeah, so this is about, it's mainly the story of this incredible guy. His name's Daniel Kish. He's been blind basically since he was about 2 years old, had to have both of his eyes removed. And he was raised by a family who just said, you know, so what? I'm not going to impose rules on him. I'm not going to coddle him. And by the time he was eight, he'd figured out how to ride a bike using echolocation, which is sort of like what bats do, a clicking of the tongue. You throw a sharp sound out at the wall and you can kind of tell a little bit about what's in front of you. Anyway, and he is just, I mean, often there have been stories about him. He's often called a kind of superhero. But what he says is, no, press, media, you have it wrong. This is normal. it's society that's holding back most people who are blind. And I don't want to be called a freak of nature. I don't want to be called a Superman. I want to show to the world that low expectations for what blind people can do are really holding back most people. And I happen to escape that because of some odd things about my family. It ends up being an hour about how expectations, your expectations that you hold in your mind about what people around you can do, can really change even the physiology of the people around you. It sounds like spooky, you know, laser thoughts,
Absolutely. Been
science. And so the piece starts with he is leading me on a hike. And I think the listener at this moment doesn't know that he's blind.
Right. And then I think that the clip that we have actually is a rather dramatic moment in which he shows you his eyes in a quite dramatic way. Let's listen to the clip.
Could we look at your eyes?
In terms of them being out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, in a somewhat surreal gesture, Daniel pulls down his lower eyelids.
Let me just...
And removes his eyes.
Okay.
They're prosthetic, of course, and they clink a little bit as he hands them over to me.
That's so cool.
Two of the most beautiful hazel blue eyes I've ever seen in the palm of his hand.
Can I hold?
Yeah.
Okay. Is it okay, my hand?
Mm-hmm.
I think. Wow. They're so lifelike. Does it feel odd to not have them in?
Yes.
Oh, it does?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
That's a clip from the NPR podcast Invisibilia. My guest is co-host Lulu Miller, who speaks tomorrow afternoon at CAM Raleigh, part of Hopscotch Design Festival. You know, it's an amazing meditation because, I mean, obviously there's that dramatic moment and then the message that, you know, don't hold blind people back. Your expectations are too low. But there's a far broader implication here, which is that we're all holding each other back. Why can't we all do echolocation? You know, we sort of think, oh, well, you have this extra sense because you've lost that. I doubt it. I think we just don't give enough attention to those senses because we're super saturated with everything else. And so we limit ourselves and the power that we might have. That's the meditation. That's the sort of deep thoughts that a program like that bring me to anyway. I think the power of
nice.
A program like yours as well, because you think, well, how am I holding myself back? What can I do that just because of these other things that I've become so satisfied in and so you know, committed to my story that I'm missing, right? Is
right,
that part
absolutely.
Of his...
And and like for me, the one of the broader learnings about that piece was I have to be careful, you know, like literally who I situate myself around, like that the people around me, if I'm in a group that has a certain narrative or has low expectations, that can get into my skin.
Right.
Whereas if I go like surround myself with my buddies and my champions, like that can make a real difference. And so like I think I thought about it literally as like where are you spending your time?
Yeah.
Where are you placing yourself?
That's very good.
And, and realizing we're not as durable as we think. We're permeable. It's to people's thoughts and expectations of us. We are permeable.
So tell us about the focus of your talk at Hopscotch, because it revolves around the story of a man named Ken. Tell us that story.
Yes. Okay. So this is kind of a leap for me. It's just been a little like pet theory I've been thinking about for 5 or 6 years now. And so I'm calling it The House and the Bicycles, : The Perverse Trap Your Mind Sets for You to Fail, and How to Break Free. So that probably sounds a little confusing, but basically the idea is, okay, the panel is about ways, you know, it's a design conference, and so it's about ways of hacking yourself. And the thing I've noticed over the years is this odd kind of relationship between the thing you really care about, a creative project you really, really want to do with all your heart, maybe your calling, your passion, and then like hobbies or procrastination, and how sometimes the thing that you really want that gives you meaning can feel so hard and so daunting to work on. Whereas the hobby, you know, for me, that might be making little drawings. Like I'll draw people on the train or draw people like extensively intricate greeting cards just because I find it really fun. How the hobby is something you take pleasure in and, oh, you actually do. You're actually like prolific at doing. Whereas, you know, for me, one of my deep, deep private passions is writing and I have basically nothing to show for it. So so that was a feeling I'd always just sort of noticed. And then I met this guy named Ken about 6 years ago in Charlottesville. I had just moved to that town and he was known in town as sort of the bike guy. He just made bikes constantly from parts he would find in junkyards. He was constantly scouring them. He'd make like bikes from the 1940s or the 70s or these colorful sort of chimeras, very elegant. Seems like everyone was on a Ken bike. Made them out of his garage, just adored it, would light up when he was talking about bikes. But then I found out one day when I went to get my bike fixed by him that bikes are not his passion. All he has been trying to do for 10 years is build a house. And when I say a house, I mean like a home. He had sort of like for many years, he was about 50, he had been sort of transient and he wanted to build a home that would have rafters from days that would remind him of days of sailing, and it would have a warm hearth that kind of reminded him of his boyhood, and it would answer all this big stuff. But every day by about 11 a.m. he'd be working on it and he'd feel so daunted by what it could be and so daunted by how incompetent he felt as a house builder, because this was all new to him, that he'd be out the door in the garage working on the bikes. And I remember he said to me that day, you know, there seems like there's this odd relational power between the two that in a way it's not just about procrastination. We all know the feeling of feeling frozen and too daunted and wanting to go do anything else. But also, perversely and sickly, the bikes almost need the house. Uh-huh. And that without the daunting, the shadow of the house, the bikes would sort of lose their fun. And so he said that, I remember, like an odd relational power between the two. And that's when I began thinking about the creative process, this weird relation between hobby and passion and as sort of a metaphor.
Actually, Ken reflects on that. We have a clip where he talks about that relationship. Let's listen.
There's a sense of art and mystery, and joy working on the bikes that I don't necessarily feel when I'm working on the house. The house is a project that I'm supposed to be doing, that I need to get done, that will have, I think, quite a positive impact on my life when I get finished with it.
So there's a clip of bike maker Ken speaking with Invisibilia's Lulu Miller, who will speak tomorrow at Cam Raleigh as part of the Hopscotch Design Festival. So as you get deeper and deeper into this, I mean, how much of this then becomes about the story of why this house would give me pleasure at all and why bikes do? I mean, this seems to be a sort of a deeper question about what is it I get when I finish this thing, either one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And also what I guess sort of the question for me was, well, I guess how the heck do I take the joy, the authentic joy that I feel on the quote unquote bike project? So again, the hobby, the thing you actually do, the drawing, the just giddy joy and prolific power, like the productivity. How can I harness some of that juju and put it onto the house project? Like, is there some way to, I sort of wondered, is there some way to trick my brain back, you know, and make it go the other way? And I think basically what the talk is going to be about is looking at what ended up being for me sort of a 5-year journey of experiments and trying to break free and failing in various ways until Ken, I'll just tell you the ending, but until Ken called me up one day, literally 5 years later, and said, I think I figured a way out. And he said, you know, I think what you need to do is throw away your blueprint, throw away your dreams for everything that the house could be. It will remind me of boyhood and sailing. And, you know, because those dreams, that blueprint, though, it can often feel like the fuel, the reason you get out the door and work on it, I think it's actually the brakes and it's what is constricting me. And so I think that is sort of this odd thing that can be really hard to do every day. But to step out of the metaphor, in a way, what it means is just sit down on the big dream project and let and just work on it. Let it be what it is today. Let you, without your dreams of everything it could be, you'll do just fine with everything you've got in your head.
Lulu Miller is co-host of the NPR podcast Invisibilia. You can see her tomorrow at Cam Raleigh, part of the Hopscotch Design Festival. Lulu, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much, Frank. It was really fun.
You can find out more about Invisibilia and Hopscotch at our website, stateofthings.org. And we preview some of the music of Hopscotch with singer-songwriter Joan Shelley next. Stay with us.